Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Full or part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
And so here we are in the middle of a fun drive, and we're taking time for the Media Project. Isn't this an exciting thing? Here we are at a point when the very survival of WAMC is at stake, and we're talking about the media.
More than you think, Rex, because the most incredible thing happened during the first debate. Mitt Romney got up there, and he announced that his first thing to save money was going to be cutting the money from public media, public broadcasting, which, you know, is like 0.001% of the budget. But he did it, I believe, to make sure that his base, who hates public broadcasting, the conservative base, would like him more and go out and vote. But what he didn't realize is he was doing it the day before the fund drive went on the air. And so what's great is that he not only riled his base, he riled ours too. And boy, were people angry about that. You know, the fact that he's going to kill Big Bird. And what he said was, you know, I like Big Bird and I like you, to Jim Lehrer, who is the moderator.
That must be somebody calling in a contribution right now. You know, it's a pretty funny thing.
So go right ahead.
We will.
But anyway,
so it's a great
better.
Thing. That's Dr. Alan Shartok, of course, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. And here we are with the publisher, Ira Fussfeld from the Daily Freeman in Kingston.
Hello.
Sir.
Hello.
How are you? Are you answering Alan's phone? That's very
nice. No. I was nervous. I thought it was mine for a second.
Yeah.
Glad to see it was his.
I turned mine off. I hope you all understand that that's it. The worst thing is when you go into a major concert hall and I'm listening to some beautiful piece of Mozart, and you know, people want to kill those phones. So I always make sure my phone is.
Well, if you watched the prelude to the debates on C-SPAN, which says something about my life that I was actually watching it, they show the admonitions that they give the crowd before the debate starts, and they not only reminded them that they should shut off the phones because we don't want them to ring, but they said, don't just put them on mute, shut them off, because as you know, even if they're silent, the lights of the phone will come on and might distract the people on the stage.
So, and then finally, you should know, as an old radio man, which I now am, you have to know that if there's any electronic device around, and even if you have it on mute, the electronic device will cause a static in the sound system.
As has happened on this very program.
It has indeed.
With an iPad, not to be mentioned, of the owner of whom. Whatever that means. Yeah. The owner of which.
But you know what, Rex? Somehow we've let this thing
up
get
with
away.
Which I will not put.
What is this program about?
Yeah. Well, I was leading into it, but people
kept
rambling.
But I don't think they know who Ira is.
No, we do. They all know who I am, but he did say
attention.
Who I am.
Yeah.
Yes. They don't know who Alan is.
I
don't know that they know who you are.
I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, but we actually have done all of that, so we're good. I was actually at a conference of journalists, the New York State Associated Press Association meeting, where somebody from your company, Ira, appeared, and at which, by the way, the Times Union won the award as a newspaper of distinction, the outstanding newspaper in the state in its category.
I want to congratulate you.
Thank you.
Who are you up
Thank
against?
You. Oh, Syracuse, Binghamton, Schenectady, Rochester, Middletown, Times Herald Record.
Buffalo, probably.
Well, who won the big award for the big papers?
I don't know. Typically, Newsday does, but that's not everybody. It is a little bit more difficult there because not everybody enters that contest. Like, the Times usually doesn't put itself up for that. So, interesting situation.
What do you mean? You won them, but you didn't put yourself up?
Well, there's a judging requirement. You actually have to submit newspapers to be judged. And if they don't submit newspapers, then they're not, in fact, in the competition.
But you did.
Well, we did. They and in my size category, they all do. So anyway, I'm about to talk about something else here.
You're very lucky, Rex, and I'll tell you
that was the digital first. Well, I would really like to talk about the media here.
I know, but the media does include these prizes that get given out, and I'm very interested in this. And I really want to compliment you, first of all, because I think you do run a very important newspaper that does things that other newspapers don't do.
Thank you.
For example, you do. You really cover state government.
That's what the judges made note of. They said political and government coverage is obviously at the heart of this newspaper, and they said they thought we did it well.
At a time when newspapers are dying all over the place, and the way that they deal with that is that they fire a lot of staff and stuff like that. Everybody does. But what you guys do is you still have this tradition of investigative reporting and reporting on government, which is extraordinary. And despite the fact that I hate to compliment you on anything, Rex, you deserve a lot of credit for what you've done here.
Well, thank you. It's not me, but it is really a wonder because it's a wonderful sort of culture that's been established that really can make a difference in a newspaper. But the interesting thing at this conference was this guy named Steve Buttrey,
who is our, I don't know what his title is, but he's our digital guru in the digital world at Digital First Media, which is part of our company.
And he was talking about how digital journalists think as opposed to how traditional journalists think. And the first thing he said was, story is a process, not a product. It's a really interesting thought that a story is not just something that you create and send out there, but it's something that is ongoing. And I was thinking of this during the debates because people were live tweeting, of course, what's going on in the debate. And the point that Buttrey was making was that kind of live reporting actually gives you more coverage in the same amount of time. So you're actually giving your news consumers a greater amount. It doesn't have the analytical quality or this summation that can be brought to a story, but it really does give you some ongoing coverage and some insight into the sort of instant analysis or instant reactionist stuff. We put a little bit of that stuff in the print product then the day after the debate.
Sure.
We actually use some of those tweets. It's kind of fun.
But as you probably know, I read the New York Times all night long. I get up and I read the New York Times, and the story constantly changes. Your point is very well taken. It doesn't always change, but quite frequently it does, based on something new that has happened. You know, you said analytical, and I have to tell you, I have great trouble with newspapers which try to be, or say they're neutral information transmitters, turning out to be more partisan than I would have hoped. After the debate, the first Romney-Obama debate, Romney was loudly declared by many people, including the New York Times, on the front page as the winner of the debate. They may not have said, he wins, you lose, you know, Yankees 2, Orioles 1. But it became a sporting event, and I really was quite annoyed with them for doing it. I said to myself, you know, you can say what they said, but why in the world would you say widely thought to be a winner or a loser? And while the Times may not have used those exact words, that's exactly what they did.
Well, if they said widely thought to have been the winner, that would be accurate reporting because then they're going to substantiate it with people who are saying it. If the New York Times in the coverage of the debate said Mitt Romney won the first debate in the lead paragraph, that would be editorializing. I'm presuming that it was either the former or what you're describing was in a sidebar analysis piece.
Well, before we get sued, I have to say my words were inexact. And I made that point. You know, I don't remember exactly the words at the Times.
Who's going to sue us?
But this is the Times.
Oh.
So, you
have a right to be wrong and still not get sued in this country.
See,
you can say what you like.
But I'll tell you something about being sued. Being sued for journalists and for people, especially bloggers who may be out on their own and the rest of it, is a very different thing from not having a defensible argument. You know, if you're just Joe Schmo and you're on your blog and somebody decides to sue you, yeah, you could win, but you could spend $50,000 defending yourself and mortgage your home in order to do that. And that's why lawsuits so frequently are so scary.
I want to offer something that I'm not going to suggest is good or bad, but it is certainly different. If you go back to, say, the Nixon-Kennedy debate before the internet, before the modern technology, before cable TV, You would watch the debate or listen to debate, and then you would pick up your newspaper or papers the next morning, and you would read about the debate, and then you would read the analysis of the debates. But before you read them, you would have had 12 hours or so to come to your, to think about it if you're so inclined, and to come to your own opinion. Then we move forward to the cable age, where as soon as the debate is ending, the discussions and the finger pointing, et cetera, is immediately happening before you even had a chance to digest it. And now I was watching the debates last night with my iPad in front of me and my Twitter feed on, and watching a variety of the news organizations or personalities whom I follow, literally on a point-by-point basis, commenting on what they had just seen and what I had just seen, what we'd all just seen. And on the one hand, isn't this great? We're all tied into this digital community, and we're hearing it, and it's all in real time. On the other hand, I didn't have a chance to really digest it all. And then beyond that, and I'd defer to Alan as the political scientist, is the way to judge the debate on a point-by-point basis as if it was a boxing match? Or should you, is, you know, do you want to say he's this? Or do you want to be able to judge it in its entirety after it's all over? Because certainly from a stylistic standpoint, Romney was clearly the winner of that debate, not talking anything about substance. He was the most aggressive. He was the most animated. He looked like he was the most interested. And that was reflected in these tweets, certainly, which reinforced the belief that Romney, to your point, won the debate.
Well, it does become a sporting event. I don't like that. I don't like the fact that because there's so many parts, as you indicate, of this whole thing. So, for example, when he goes out and he says to the first thing he would do is to get rid of, Big Bird and cut this out so we don't have to borrow the money to put him on the television from the Chinese. That's just crap. And it tells me a great deal about who this man is. Now, it doesn't certainly, you know, you want to play. My wife used to be a debate coach, so she can tell you who wins the debate. But I think this is, to reduce it to style points and the rest of it, is a very silly thing.
What about the echo effect? What about the fact that people, when they hear somebody saying...
bandwagon.
There is that effect in politics too, isn't there? Where if people want to be on the winning team, and therefore they will go along with
whatever
they hear.
That's right, and we're going to see a big bump for Romney as a result of this malfeasance on the part of the journalistic community.
The malfeasance. Now, I think Ira's point was that they were just reflecting the points that others were making, that commentators.
Well, you know, I, as I said, I had about a dozen journalists who I follow on Twitter, and they were all updating, and they were giving their opinion as the event was going on. And I guess what I was disturbed about it, although I understand this is where we're all going, is I'd like opinions, whether it's from a debate or whether whatever the subject is that we, for example, may discuss on our editorial pages, are considered opinions and not gut opinions that are emitted instantly. And sometimes you might find an opinion that you said did you want to bring right back, but it's too late. It's out there.
Well, you know, Ira, this is a point you've made twice now. And as I often say on my Vox Pop program, when it comes around a second time, you know, you're done.
I'm glad I drove up in the fog this morning.
I understand. But in all due respect to you, Ira, and I do mean this respectfully, because as you know, I love you and you're a great friend of mine and all the rest of it, and a great colleague. But I have to say, nobody gives a damn because you can't go back. Ira, we are here, and that's it.
Well, that's the point I'm trying to make, okay. Mr. Shartok, Professor the Doctor.
This is the media world,
and this is where we are today, and there is no turning back. But I'm just wondering, in the context of the media discussion, is what do you think about it? And it is something that is happening in the media world.
Yes, and in the Twitter age, anyone can immediately render swift and harsh judgment, and it's visited upon not only the candidates, but upon the moderators. For example, Jim Lehrer, who moderated the first presidential debate, was under attack before the first comment was made as, why is he the moderator? And during the debate and after, there were some questions as to whether he was up to the task.
The complaints about him on the Twitter world were brutal.
You guys know, of course, maybe as a political scientist, I pay more attention to this than you do, but you know they changed the rules of this debate. that allowed these guys to get in there bare knuckles as opposed to having to listen to the moderator. So I don't know that the American people were really fully informed that the rules had changed and that it looked like things had gotten out of control.
I did know that, and I agree with you. And you almost didn't need him to do anything else but to introduce
sure.
two candidates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting. It was certainly a milder form of moderation than we typically have. And there wasn't the kind of thing that I've seen happen in local debates where the moderator is so strict about time limits that they will interrupt a member of Congress or something in the middle of a sentence or at the very end of a sentence and say, no, your time is up. You got to get out of here, which I think is A, disrespectful, and B, doesn't serve the interests of people seeking information. So I like this sort of looser format of the debate.
Well, Rex, again, with great respect for you, sir. I have to say, I don't agree with that. I think what happens is bullies then begin to take over the microphone. They don't respect the rules. They just keep going and they just keep pushing. And if you got one nice guy and, you know, one respectful person, and I think Obama certainly was that yesterday, and you get somebody who has been told to be aggressive and do the rest of it and take advantage of this format, I think it makes him look like a bully. I do, and anyway, and I do as a frequent moderator of these debates over the years, I do call people to task because I don't like bullies.
Yeah, I wouldn't interrupt somebody unless they really keep doing it. I would. I've also done moderation, and I will let somebody finish a sentence and then call them to task for it and say, as Jim Lehrer tried to do at one point last night, that was way over 2 minutes or something. And it's interesting. Eventually, I think the point gets across to listeners that somebody's taking advantage and somebody isn't.
Well, Lehrer also had to be aware. As you pointed out, before the debates, there was already claims of bias against the Presidential Debate Commission for all of the moderators that have been chosen. And if Lehrer had interrupted one candidate or the other, as you suggest occasionally should be done, the screams from the partisans would have overshadowed much of what the two sides had to say.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, we need to talk about a couple of other topics here in case people aren't interested in presidential debates. And that has to do, let's just talk for a second about this remarkable situation of an anchor who was criticized, a Wisconsin television anchor, a local morning show anchor, who got a tweet from or an email from a viewer criticizing her physical appearance.
To wit, that she was fat.
He said, surely you don't consider yourself a suitable example for this community's young people, girls in particular. Obesity is one of the worst choices a person can make and one of the most dangerous habits to maintain. I leave you this note, hoping you'll reconsider your responsibility as a local public personality to present and promote a healthy lifestyle. The question being then, is it unfair for someone to call out this anchor for being overweight, which she admits she is, or was this guy right to say, hey, you're an example to young women and you need to present a healthier visage to the public? What do we think here?
I think that the email was a private email to this woman who chose to make it public, and I would focus on that for a second. I read the email. I think all three of us have received similarly critical email of ourselves in one form or another that were much worse than this particular email.
Wait, nobody's ever called you fat, have they?
No, not in the last 10 minutes. But people write nasty things in email, and you usually shrug it off. It annoys you for a while and shrug it off. This anchor chose to make this an issue.
She said there's gold in them hills.
Well,
I don't know. She made it an issue, and I think it's good because she called a bully to a task.
Right. I certainly agree with her position, and she suitably answered this critic. I just don't know why she chose to bring this critic's complaints to light, because it's just one of many nasty emails that we all get.
It turns out it was very good for ratings.
It was very good for ratings, and she got on all the networks
and two of the major morning shows.
Yeah.
And she became famous because she stood up to the bullies. I like it.
But there is a substantive question about the complaint that this guy, this critic made, and you've talked about it a number of times in this program,
really?
Which is how the appearance of TV anchors matters, so it seems, to those who put those anchors in place. And so generally speaking—
Especially if they're female.
Especially if they're female. And so you will rarely see an overweight woman on the set of an anchor desk. And the fact that she's there speaks favorably about the broadcast team that put her there. But I do think that the question is an interesting one that the guy raises, because people do look at people on TV, rightly or wrongly, as role models. And I'm speaking as someone who's overweight. So, you know, do you think that if Chris Christie runs for president, his weight will be a factor?
Yeah, I think people make fun of him, but he's a man. And men are entitled to do that according to some of the worst parts of American culture and stereotyping, and women are not. Now, I thought one of the great things was, and I hope this is never going to be interpreted the wrong way, but that they chose Candy Crowley to be one of the moderators, because she's a little overweight too. And yet, I think it's almost a conscious decision to say, what we think and how we act is much more important than the way we look.
I just want to be misunderstood. I'm on the woman's side. I think it's a shame that she got this email, and she should be judged on her performance, not on her weight. I just think I would not have read this private email on the air, and I would have just ignored it or dealt with it my own way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hate to be cynical, which I think is probably what you might be accused of being, about why she brought it out. Yeah. She says her line was, "I don't tolerate crap." And she wanted, therefore, to fight back at this. But you do have to note that all of us who have positions like this, where we're sort of in the public eye, get a lot of crap, let's say, from people. I get a guy who calls me virtually every morning and leaves a extremely nasty message. And many people who do it a little bit more sporadically than that. One fellow pickets my public appearances and hands out flyers about what a terrible person I am. It started when the opinion pages, without my knowledge, declined to publish a letter to the editor that he had written about the location of the restrooms at the Times Union Center, the arena in downtown Albany, where we have the naming rights, but we didn't build the building.
And, of course, you know that I have a few
detractors, do you?
I mean, I get anti-Semitic mail. I mean, I'm not going to get on a soapbox. Why raise more attention to it? Because that's essentially what these people want to have happen. They want to see you get agitated, and they want to elevate it.
Well, she got tremendous credit from around the country for standing up to bullies.
So sometimes attention, even if it's bad or good, is good. What about this attention? Fox Network aired live a suicide at the end of a car chase. Did you see this? Tell me about that.
How did that? I mean,
the question that is in my mind is why this is newsworthy. They had helicopter coverage coming from their NBC affiliate in Phoenix that Fox put on the air. And started using this. Shepard Smith was in the anchor chair, and this fellow, after a chase, his car was off in the sand, and he got out of his car and was running and falling and obviously distraught. And you kept hearing the anchor, Shep Smith, saying, "Oh, this is not looking good.
Right.
Oh, this is not looking good." And yet the camera stayed on live, and the man then
Camera stayed on, but the control room didn't cut it off. And, and in fact, as I understand it, they were on a 5-second delay, and they could have cut it off. And so he got upset. And I think it was genuine. Shepard Smith is a pretty good journalist and has a pretty good reputation, his affiliation notwithstanding, at Fox. So they blamed it on human error, but
human error. Well, of course it was human error. I mean, those are not machines that operate without humans. It was on the part of a director and a producer.
Right.
And if you say that Shepard Smith was trying to get it stopped, all I heard was him basically saying, "Oh wow, look at that. Oh, this is bad. Oh wow, wow, wow," and then bemoaning it once it had already happened. So it seems to me it was an extremely bad taste of Fox. And yet, of course, now then everybody. We're able to talk about Fox, and maybe that attention is good.
The other dynamic is, ever since the slow speed chase with O.J. Simpson, cable in particular and local channels seems to love these kind of chases. They have the technology with helicopters and cameras in them, and it makes compelling TV. We're watching a wreck, literally, and this one went too far.
But it's like that earlier point about how the live stuff can skew your attention, because I remember watching a brief hostage situation involving a school bus on some live feed in the middle of the day, and I thought it was so huge, and I devoted a third of the front page to this story. Mm-hmm. This is now some years ago. And nobody else in the country did it outside that local market, because it was over and done with. And I thought it was so dramatic because I had witnessed it live.
How often it happens with me all the time when we do something differently than everybody else, and I will go in and I'll ask the editor at the time, "Are we that smart or are we that stupid? We're the only ones doing this thing."
On a totally different subject, very quickly, within a few seconds, Next week, I hope we can talk about the fact that the Murdoch organization is splitting. What will happen to the New York Post, which loses a ton of money?
Ooh.
There's some speculation that it's goodbye.
Want to buy it?
Wow. Hey, that would be a great
put them under the WAMC umbrella.
There's a cool idea. Man. So you have a reason to listen to next week's show, folks. When the fun drive will be over, Alan will be triumphant and we'll all be happy. And if you haven't called 1-800-323-9262, you should. Meanwhile, you can write to us, media@wamc.org. The publisher, the professor, and the editor, thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Thanks, Rex.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known.